Oh, hey there. I'm Guy Branum, and welcome to Pop Rocket, a weekly show picking over all the pop culture we love to love. With me to talk TV, film, music, and anything else entertaining are pop culture scholar and dyke about town, Karen Toxin.
Hey, Guy. Hi, Rocketeers.
How's it going?
It's going wellish.
It's good.
It's fine. It's hard. Like, the world is in a constant state of tragedy and despair, but, there's always a lesbian pool party to take my mind off it.
Fair. And film critics Alonzo Giraldi and Dave White. I don't know if I am comfortable with introducing the two of you as a married pair together, like with one title to introduce both of you. Also, I don't know, just sort of like procedurally, who has to hello me now.
Well, clearly we've subsumed our identity into one person, so
yes.
I'll say hello.
Hello.
Isn't subsuming two personhoods into one identity what we were fighting for all of those years?
We're living the dream.
Coming up on this week's show, it's our Netflix and Chill episode. We're going to talk about Netflix movies and series you need to watch. Plus, we'll each be sharing our latest jams. But first, let's find out what arts, entertainment, news, or events have caught our attention this week. Dave White, what are you all about this week?
There's a new movie out. It's called Escapes. And maybe you don't know about this new movie because it's...
I do not.
In limited release, it is from director Michael Almereyda. If you happen to see a film called Experimenter a couple years ago with Winona Ryder about the 1961 Milgram experiment, same filmmaker. This is a documentary about a character actor named Hampton Fancher. And is that a name that you are familiar with? If not... He wrote Blade Runner. Well, he adapted.
I was like, does he wear like seersucker shorts?
Blade Runner, yeah. He adapted Blade Runner. But other than that, he was just sort of this 1950s, 60s character actor that you would see on Gunsmoke and Mannix. Handsome guy. Nothing special about him to put him over the top. What was special about him and what the documentary is
I
about.
I feel like we're coming up onto the corner that's going to go into like a major kink or an unsolved murder.
Not at all.
This is not autofocus.
What you find out about him is that he lived the life that people wish they could have when they come to Hollywood and decide they're going to be a movie star. Well, he was never much of a movie star, but he had adventures. And he hung out with Marlon Brando, and he married Sue Lyons, and he dated Barbara Hershey and Terry Garr. And he narrates this film in a series of incredibly digressive stories that you're fascinated by. And the reason you're fascinated by them is because he's a good storyteller, and also because Michael Almereyda loves the idea of packaging this man in a movie and letting you know you are watching a movie. He's really great at juxtaposing a million clips. And all the title cards where Hampton Fancher is the fifth person in the cast. And by the end of it, you think nothing about his life is especially great, but he's fascinating. And I'm glad I know who he is now.
Mr. Giraldi.
Golly,
what are you all about, let me say?
This week I'm all about a new document, also a documentary, a film called Whose Streets, which I saw last Wednesday and thought it was powerful and gripping and really moving. It's about the...
Doesn't seem topical to me.
Well,
I don't understand how
it's so irrelevant.
Exactly. Seeing it Wednesday and thinking about it now are two totally different things. But yeah, it's only increased in stature over the last few days. It's basically on the ground in Ferguson after the Mike Brown shooting, and you know, just talking to the people who lived there, the people who were in those original sort of confrontations with the police of just trying to protest, trying to have their voices heard, being met with the tear gas and the rubber bullets and all that stuff. And you know, and as the story unfolds and as the cop doesn't get indicted, you know, the community gets angrier and is trying to figure out sort of how to get their message across and how to be heard and how to avoid just getting shot at all the time by the police. And this film just feels unfiltered and direct. There's a lot of handheld, you know, people's phone footage. But you know, you have these scenes where like this guy just unpacks this duffel bag of, here's a spent tear gas canister and here are some rubber bullets that I picked up off the ground. And just, it looks like he just walked out of a combat zone. And it's Ferguson, Missouri, people trying to have dialogue with the police, and this is what they get.
How present are documentarians in that?
They're not first personing at all. They're telling people stories. They're not appearing on camera. They're not eyeing it at all. It is very much letting the community be the movie.
Karen, I would like to propose a semi-shared what we're all about, okay?
A beshared all about?
going in a big way on the Hulu program that you were planning on speaking about.
Yeah.
And then a little bit of Shonda, and then if you'll give me just a brief corner to mention Big Brother. I feel like with a married couple here, we have to
form now an we alliance. Have to enact. Exactly.
And also, neither of us watch Game of Thrones, guys. So sorry about that.
And I haven't in a little while. So, what I'm all about this week is Difficult People, which is three episodes into its third season on Hulu. And I think that moment that we wait for on a show where you're waiting for everything to coalesce, you're waiting for the ensemble to just bounce off each other, is happening on Difficult People. I mean, it's been good for the first two seasons, and last season especially I thought was terrific. But there's something about the kind of timing and the way all the players are working with one another.
Cola Scola knows who changing. He is. He's fucking eating that scenery.
Yeah.
And it was lovely to have the waitress at the restaurant.
Shakina Nifak?
Yes. Feel as like a part of the ensemble, enmeshed in it, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I think that like everyone's purpose has finally like kind of, you know, becoming fulfilled now in the context of the show. I also really appreciate the, you know, I'm not sure whether they were in production before or after the election, but I certainly appreciate the way that they're, you know, depicting the dystopia we currently live in, but with a certain level of like portending in it, like, to, you know, like a certain form of projection. I think that they must have written some of this stuff before they knew what would happen. And it's funny because some of the more absurd aspects of what they imagine a Trump regime to be seemed not that far away from the truth in the current moment.
One of my friends, I forget whether I mentioned this before, but one of my friends noted that Friends from College is a show that was written with the expectation that Hillary Clinton would be our next president. And the polite little problems of well-heeled Harvard grads was something that we would find delicious. And one of my big problems with political comedy over the course of the past like 5 or 6 years, The Daily Show age, longer than that, is that it is all scoffing-based. And God knows, like, Julie Klausner loves to scoff at something, but she also loves to turn it into a monstrous caricature of what it is. Like, you know, it is
the Pence conversion therapy plan for gays.
Or that it is a New York where Quiznos is the most reliable purveyor of healthcare. It's so good. It's so wonderfully non-naturalistic. That show has the best jokes on television. Mm-hmm. There is an extended sequence where I love this B-plot so much because, as I tweeted earlier, regardless of how Jewish it is, it's still not as Jewish as an episode of Transparent. But
the Dybbuk.
Yes, Billy's sister-in-law believes that there's a Dybbuk in the basement. So they have to get a minion that is a 10 Jewish men, a prayer quorum, together. So they put together a fake J-Swipe ad, and they are together composing like the perfect Jewish woman. And it's like Rebecca from Brandeis or Debbie from Brandeis or something like that. And she has breasts that are as heavy and dense as a bag full of gravel. And an ass as wide, white, and flat as the day is long. And it killed me. I love it so much.
Yeah, Transparent is still peak Judaism, for sure, no question.
Fucking Havdalah candle in their Emmy campaign.
Right? I love that they managed to work in like an a cappella group from Swarthmore as part of the Dybbuk like kind of expelling ritual.
It's the wonderful thing is there's a lot about peak TV that bothers me, and I think we do live in a time that doesn't have the infrastructure to produce quality in a lot of ways. But at its best, it lets a very, very talented person do what she or he wants. And the thing is that like the skills of Cola Scola and Billy Eichner and everyone else in that cast, Gabby Sidibe, are very, very present. But at the end of the day, Julie Klausner has some things to say, you know? And that's what that show is. And it's wonderful.
No, absolutely. And I just even love the way that she depicts the sort of drama around the uselessness of her husband in relation to their kind of sexual their sexual acts and the switching codes of her patterns of desire. And I mean, like, every little bit of it, from the intimate stuff to the kind of broad sweeping like social satire, is really fucking funny.
Well, also, one of the things that bothers me about our current single cam comedy world is I think it creates too big of a world, and you never know where you are. Last season of Girls, there were characters who dipped out for like several episodes, and this show does an interesting job of finding the middle ground. And I'm just saying all of this so I can say, every time we go to PBS, I love it. Every time we're at PBS, like, shit on PBS. Okay.
And it's a better Andrea Martin delivery system than Good News. Let's just be frank about that.
Okay, look, I have a lot of personal relationships to this entire game. But can we just say, Andrea Martin gives us two interventionist moms, like two gross caricatures of two writer, creator, performers moms, and they are such different creatures.
Yes, absolutely.
It is really amazing watching her on that show and realizing in a couple of months I'm going to get her in a Chico's top trying to make photocopies.
Put her in all the shows.
So my brief all about this week is the end of Jody on Big Brother. We opened up our Big Brother season with six hot people finding each other and immediately starting showmances, creating what everyone assumed was an unbreakable block of showmances. Unfortunately, Cody, the former military sniper and aggroiest of the bros, attempted like a bold and dickish move the first week, and it all came crashing down. And so the rest of the house has been trying to destroy Cody and Jessica, known as Jody, for weeks. And
okay. I was like, Jody's two people, not one.
Yes, there are three showmances.
Okay.
There's Matt and Raven, called Maven. Uh-huh. There's Mark and Elena, called Marlena. And then there was Cody and Jessica, called Jody. And I love that all of their couple names were just ladies' names from soap operas.
Matt and Raven could have been rats.
That would have been, a much better description of... Raven's got some interesting, like, extensions in. Like, it's real bad. But, like, our big villains of the show are finally being taken out. And we all come with the question, can Paul simply run all over everybody like that? And the answer is yes.
That's the person who did not have the showmance.
He does not have a showmance. Okay. He was brought back from last season, and he is, to use the terminology of Survivor, a Boston Rob.
Okay.
A returning asshole who the producers have basically set up to be able to run the entire season because they liked him so much. And that would be more charming if a similar setup weren't running the White House right now. I honestly, my big thought of today is, like, this is a real digression and I'm sorry about it. Like, to the extent that our president did not come to make friends, he came to win. And, like, so much of the way he communicates is like a reality show contestant. He cannot read a script and make it believable. Mm-hmm. And you always know what he means when he says it. And he is always giving us confessionals over Twitter. I do wonder, should we get Sandra Diaz-Twine to take him down? Like, should we just find...
Single-handedly bringing Sandra Diaz-Twine into profound prominence, global prominence.
I'm sorry I bring it up so much. All right. You are listening to Pop Rocket. We're going to be right back to talk about Netflixing and chilling right after this. Hey guys, Dollar Shave Club is the smarter choice. Get a great shave at a great price, conveniently delivered right to your door. Dave and I both use the product.
Yep.
Dave, why is it great?
Not only is it super cheap, it comes in the amount that I need.
For a limited time, new members get their first month of the Executive Razor with a tube of their Dr. Carver's Shave Butter for only $5. After that, razors are just a few bucks a month. That's a $15 value for only $5. In your first month box, you get an awesome weighty handle, four cartridges, and their Shave Butter. Also, there's like a little cartoon thing in it that tells you about the month. That's very fun. After your first month, replacement cartridges ship automatically at their regular price. There are no hidden fees, and no commitments. Cancel anytime you like. You can only get this offer exclusively at DollarShaveClub.com/rocket. That's DollarShaveClub.com/rocket.
The three of you enter a cave of a big red dragon and is standing over a hoard of precious golden rubies. And he says, "What do you do, adventurers? I'm a dragon man."
I cast fire on him. It's very good.
I address the red dragon and say, "Us, we're the hosts of The Adventure Zone, a podcast about family playing Dungeons & Dragons."
Very good synergy. Commit to the bit.
I roll to charm new listeners. It is very effective. Against all odds.
Everybody, we're the Macroids. We host The Adventure Zone, a podcast where we play Dungeons & Dragons together. It's a comedy podcast. We don't take the rules too seriously because there's a lot of them and we did not take the time to learn them. Maybe listen to us. We come out every other Thursday on the Maximum Fun Network. You can find us on iTunes or on MaximumFun.org. I think this promo is a critical hit.
Welcome back to Pop Rocker. I'm your host, Guy Branum. With me in the studio are
Alonzo Duraldi,
Dave White,
and Karen Tongson.
And during the break, Dave brought up the very compelling point. Dave and I should be watching the same sexy young people reality show. So, Rocketeers, let us know. Should it be Bachelor in Paradise or should it be Big Brother?
Or both.
Or
I've
both.
I've got time.
It's summer television. We thought, at a time when we have a glut of Netflix programming, to talk about what we've been Netflixing and chilling with. Netflix and chilling with? How do I make it a gerund, Karen?
Is it surfiat or is it surfeit?
I don't know. You're the English professor.
Well, I think the British say surfeit.
Okay.
But I'm not sure.
No.
Anyway.
You're a professor.
I didn't mean to correct
the But they say aluminium, too, yeah, so exactly. We can't trust them.
If I were one of your students, you would just slap me and tell me to talk like a real American. Karen, what have you been watching on Netflix?
I've been watching a ton of shit on Netflix.
Let's start with the big picture, then. Do you feel overwhelmed by it currently?
I do feel overwhelmed by Netflix currently. Sometimes I go through those jags where I'm like, you know, kind of flipping through these 10 million things are recommended to me, and I'm like, there's nothing here. But right now, I'm not sure if there's actually anything there, but at least Netflix is making me believe or pushing the idea that there's stuff I must see. And so it may be the way they're setting the platform up these days, but I found myself, you know, kind of curiously tapping into the show Atypical. You know, I thought maybe I'll watch one or two episodes, and then like several hours later, I'm done with the whole.
And that's our teen dramedy
about a young man, an 18-year-old high school senior with Asperger's, who's a highly functioning Asperger syndrome. And it stars some big folks from the 90s, as is sort of like the Netflix model these days. Jennifer Jason Leigh doing really kind of a pitch-perfect frumpy housewife who's hot for the bartender. And Michael Rapaport playing a kind of EMT, I think, who's a bit of a schlumpy dad, but who is trying to reconnect with his kids because he couldn't deal with the autism diagnosis to begin with.
I have to say, it's a bold time anytime a family television show, doesn't just make the dad a lawyer. Like, we live in a time when everybody's so comfortable giving you solid upper middle class, and there is something nice about getting some middle class where you have some reality to it.
Yeah, and she's and JJL's character is a hairdresser,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you know, Keir Gilchrist, who plays the main character, is, you know, he does a pretty decent job of, I think, you know, not overplaying the quote-unquote developmental disability. It's not, you know, the kind of Hoffman-esque Rain Man approach to this. It's more in line with, I think it feels like, you know, the showrunner, Rabia Rashid, like, took the plot line from Parenthood with Max and decided to blow it up into a whole series. And the approach is kind of similar, too.
It does have the I was thinking about this in terms of a show like Life Goes On, you know, where it's like the let's build it around this character we haven't, the like of which we haven't really seen on TV before.
Tell millennials what that was.
Life Goes On was a show that was about a teenager with Down syndrome and his high school years and his family and how they all coped with various crises, some of which having to do with him, some not. And this one, I think, sort of feels like, yes, we're building a show around characters on the autism spectrum, but we're doing it in kind of a flippant new millennial way where the parents have their own problems and, you know, the sister is like a jock who's, you know, gives him a hard time, but also is fiercely protective of her brother.
That sounds like the sister from Speechless.
Yeah, I haven't seen enough Speechless to know.
There's a sister who's
definitely. Yeah. And who's also vaguely a little dykey, right?
Yeah. So it's they give her a love interest in the pilot.
Immediately.
Just lest we think that this short-haired runner might be,
She's so Foster-esque, Jodie Foster-esque.
Can any of the queers in the room identify the one and only thing that I liked about Life Goes On? I liked exactly.
Patti LuPone.
Can you be more specific?
Her theme, her cover of Obla Di Obla Da.
Yeah, I would. Her cover of Obla Di Obla Da. I would watch it on Sunday night.
We
and
win
then
the
be like,
newlywed game.
Obla Di Obla Da. Life goes on. La la la. Life goes on.
Alonzo, what are you watching?
I feel like my continue watching list keeps getting longer because I've watched the first two episodes of a lot of things lately. Like, I watched the first two Atypicals, I watched the first two Friends from College, I watched the first two Glows, and I like these shows, I'm interested and I want to keep going, but I feel like being a person who is in a room talking about media with other people, I have to be on top of these shows, and so I don't know that I always have the time to take the deep dive that I want to.
Dave, what's your relationship to Netflix?
I resent it entirely, and I resent Amazon and Hulu and HBO and Showtime and everybody else who is giving me a thing that I absolutely must watch. And all my friends, they come over to our house for dinner, and I made them dinner, and they're like, have you seen blah, blah, blah? And I'm like, no, fuck you. I've been making your dinner. and so they leave me alone. And I've solved my problem, though. I've solved my Netflix problem, specifically my Netflix problem.
What?
Nothing that needs me to build on anything else. So, I watch Chef's Table. I get to sit there for an hour and watch a fancy chef who lives in Slovenia. That's really one of the chefs on this season. Her name is Anna Voss, and she lives in Slovenia, and she's completely self-taught, and she's absolutely inspiring because she never went off to the rest of the world. She stayed in Slovenia. Her husband inherited a restaurant. She didn't know how to cook, and she decided to teach herself by going to the library, and now she's one of the greatest chefs in the world. And when that hour is over, I don't have to know anything more about her, and I'm never going to go to a restaurant because I'm probably never going to go to Slovenia. And what's beautiful about Chef's Table, there are three seasons. Every episode stands alone.
It's the Black Mirror model.
You can take 3 years to watch it at your leisure, because that's how I used to do it. When I was in college, I'd come home from class, watch Thundercats and Yo! MTV Raps, and then never have to pay attention to anything else. And no one was bugging me to watch 9 episodes of a show all at once so that we could have a conversation about it.
I do miss the standalone quality of television.
To your point, though, I think that if a show doesn't hit like Making a Murderer, where you got to get through that show because everybody's talking about it and somebody's going to ruin it for you and you need to be involved in all of those virtual water cooler conversations happening wherever in the internet that you are tripping over them. If a show doesn't hit like that and just sort of force you to be on top of it, it just goes on the pile, the endless pile of all the TV that we aren't watching yet.
Well, I feel like streaming is a hard place for comedy because it's good for the stuff that you have to be very engaged in. Like, the food television that you get on Netflix is more likely to be the kind of stuff that you need to sit and pay attention to as opposed to sort of like a Chopped that exists in the background while you're doing things. And, like, you have these very arch dramas that are really expecting you to care a lot about them. And I feel like One Day at a Time or Kimmy Schmidt, people don't know how they're supposed to watch these things. And they're both, I mean, One Day at a Time is so good.
It's brilliant.
The
it's
first season
really
of Kimmy
great.
Schmidt is amazing. The seasons since then have been a little bit rougher. But it's still one of the funniest things on television, and I feel
and people are watching it.
Yes.
And it's a topic of conversation.
But not in the way that Master of None is, which is a comedy,
It's true. Master of None is on Netflix, right?
Yes.
I know. Yeah, it's true. Although I think that there is, I mean, we can talk a little bit about Netflix's business model here, I think, because they're dumping money into their development in ways that are like putting them completely in the red. Like they're not going to be profitable for a long time. And they're, you know, it's something that's been a matter of discussion in the industry, whether or not this is a sustainable model for building a kind of network or a platform. And so they're, you know, they're going to really pimp these prestige projects like Master of None.
It's interesting, though, because they're doing essentially what HBO did, which mm-hmm. is sort of like, to some extent, run in the red, but then be producing these pieces of IP that you get to own and market, you know, across all media forever. Mm-hmm. And, you know, are Master of None and The Crown enough to make up for all of the Ozarks out there?
And The Defenders.
I think you know, they're banking on getting some awards and, like, you know, being at the forefront of conversation around quality in a way that they're hoping, I think, well, they hope, I believe, that they will catapult themselves into that kind of HBO stratosphere.
Well, the big move this week is, as we said earlier, Shonda Rhimes, a year before her deal was over, is leaving ABC Studios and going to Netflix. If you're Shonda Rhimes, who essentially keeps the lights on at ABC, what does it take to get you to move? Why do you end up moving? And how much money must they have offered her?
I can't begin to imagine what that deal would look like, because you're right. She is that network, and I don't know what ABC can't give her that Netflix can, apart from, you know, content limitations, I guess.
Showing butt sex,
for instance.
Right. Using swear words.
That's it.
Yeah.
Like, Atypical has so many swear words in it, and I keep forgetting it's not, like, you know, a family TV show on a family network.
Right.
Like Freeform or the former ABC Family.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, wow, everybody's saying asshole every other minute.
I never thought about before is that Shonda also is probably aware of the fact that when you go to Netflix, who doesn't have, I don't believe, a designated, like, talent exec and stuff, that has a more streamlined system of executives, being more likely to be able to cast a Filipina lead, or, you know, having diversity that isn't just the extremely attractive students on How to Get Away with Murder who are still at least a third white at all times, but being able to sort of, like, do more of the stuff that, you know, Shonda wants to do.
Sure.
Yeah, I think it opens her up to those kind of bolder casting decisions, more, maybe even, look, Shonda Rhimes is a master at the kind of bingey format. You know, like what ABC has capitalized on is her instinct at being able to create these cliffhangers that make you want to get to the next episode and that you know, make something into a water cooler sensation. And I think that there are things that she can do to her to kind of expand her cliffhanger bingey abilities on the platform in a way that, you know, we can only dare to imagine.
One thing we haven't really talked about is movies. And Netflix used to be the place where you went. Do you remember that golden age when they had everything streaming?
They had everything.
And nobody realized that was a way of making money. it was incredible. But I recently watched The Incredible Jessica James, the movie that Jessica Williams made.
I just saw that too.
It was really enjoyable. Our rom-coms have been overbaked for the past 10 or 15 years. There has been too much thought about them. And this movie was very half-baked. I enjoyed it every moment that I was watching it. They were like real characters that breathed. But the plot was loose.
Yeah.
And it felt more like the pilot of a very interesting light hour long.
When they have to spackle everything together with, like, scenes from a children's theater workshop,
yes,
you know that they need to work and develop the plot.
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned the HBO model, because I think Netflix sort of started in the same way. Oh, it's movies, and you get your DVDs in the mail. And like HBO, they sort of realized, okay, there are other places where people can get movies. What original programming can we come up with? And, you know, HBO eventually went down the road to, like, you know, Sex and the City and Sopranos, and Netflix came to the place of being, you know, Master of None and House of Cards.
A lot of Netflix's expenses, though, happen to be licensing other people's products, right?
Interesting.
So one of the reasons that they're in dumping so much money into original programming is to bypass these licensing fees, which are actually taking a huge bite out of the budget.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, so that's part of why I think they're like throwing as much material out there so that they can stop, you know, saying, okay, we'll carry season 19 of Grey's Anatomy or whatever.
Guys, a streaming app that I have been using a whole lot recently. I don't know if the two of you know, but I did watch 34 seasons of Survivor over the course of 2.5 months. I've been spending a lot of time on the CBS app. And
the All Access?
Yes. And the thing is like, it started out just because I was watching Survivor, but then it was like, damn, they have the rights to all of the Star Treks? Like, they have this, like, catalog that they're starting to take advantage of, and they're putting The Good Fight there, they're putting the new Star Trek there, and I think that there's something very responsible about a network putting effort and craftsmanship into their app, because NBC's half-assed attempt at CISO, and God knows I was on like 4 CISO shows, but it was like a money dump for streaming's got to be something. But then there was no love in it?
Well, I mean, no. Sony, I don't think, has ever quite figured out what Crackle is, apart from the place where Jerry Seinfeld does his show. And another product placement to put into the Emoji Movie that didn't help at all. But, you know, you're right. And obviously with Disney now leaving Netflix and wanting to start their own thing, I think we're going to start seeing more people. Again, if it's about not having to pay licensing fees, like, well, what do I own? What do I already have? You know, and I think, you know, probably Watch TCM is going to expand in a way or somehow unite with that Warner Archive streaming service, because they've got that whole gigantic, you know, Warner MGM RKO library they're sitting on. And but that just makes it harder for everybody who, oh, I'm going to cut the cord, you know, because now you have to subscribe to 20 million different streaming services to get it.
We have like 5 of them.
Yeah, we get Filmstruck, and we were getting CISO, and we get, you know, like Filmatique and all these different ones. And it starts adding up after a while.
That probably came to a point that was about where your cable bill was or somewhere above half of it.
In the neighborhood, yeah. I mean, we didn't cut the cord because we still have to get cable for all the other stuff that we do that's TV related.
You're media professionals, and Dave needs access to Chopped, I'm assuming.
Yeah. Mostly, I just need access to Shaws of Sunset. And I would be very happy entirely with that, which is why Netflix has come to me, as they always should have, with the infinitely shitty Chasing Cameron. Have any of y'all?
Oh, my.
No.
Oh, y'all.
Okay. So here's
the end of Western civilization.
Here's what's fantastic and god-awful about Chasing Cameron. It's about these teenage boys who are YouTube stars.
No, who, Instagram
I'm sorry,
stars.
I'm sorry, yes.
IG.
Thank you for correcting that. Instagram stars who do literally nothing except
be cute and sort of make funny faces occasionally.
Be cute and make funny faces in their videos, and they have a circuit where they do these things called mag cons, meet and greet, and these little teenage girls line up to meet them and have their selfies taken with them. And then put them on their own Instagram accounts.
They spend money to come to the thing. They take a selfie with the guy. They tag the guy, thus making his Instagram footprint even larger. And then, like, all the Instagram dudes sort of sing?
No, they don't. They don't. They toured Europe.
Oh, they jump around stage while other people are singing.
This is the plot of Chasing Cameron. They toured Europe, where they were shocked to learn that people speak other languages. And they do the meet and greet. And then they do a stage show where a DJ plays, and they come out and jump up and down. And that's what they do. And they hype the crowd, and they keep jumping up and down, and the girls scream. The show is about how dumb and cute these boys are. It's the worst thing in the world.
It's in a Netflix original series?
It is.
And it's hypnotically
riveting.
Stupid and bad.
Okay,
yeah.
I think that's very important, because one of the types of television streaming has not been giving us is that sort of thing that is in the background while you are cleaning.
Yep.
And, like, VH1... I mean, when you look at the numbers that Love and Hip Hop gets, it's one of the highest rated shows on television. And there's that slowly dying world of E! Entertainment television reality, which was at its peak when we still lived in a world with Sunset Tan. was amazing.
Which we watched.
Kat Von D. Yeah.
But it's now essentially like it's all Andy Cohen's game. And I am excited to see more bullshit like that. Also, I love people getting like... people getting a reality show and then 4 years later not having a reality show leads to a special kind of broken that I enjoy. Karen, what's the thing that you've gotten from Netflix that you would say is, this is the best? Like, this is them doing what they should be doing.
You know, it's hard for me to really parse that out at this particular point because so many differently, because Hulu's developed its own original programming, and I did cut the cord, so like everything I get is from a streaming platform now. And so it's like hard for me to differentiate or distinguish what's Netflix, what's Hulu. I'm really hard pressed to find the definitive Netflix thing. I suppose I could say The Crown, but that's really easy.
That was
what
I wanted
you know.
To say.
but I'm honestly like, I don't even think of that as, I don't think The Crown and Netflix all at once in the same thought, you know?
But that run just made me realize something. You never use the word Amazon there. Never remotely use the word Amazon. And what an interesting dynamic that Amazon came out of the gate with the prestige comedy that got all the Emmys. And then they essentially haven't been able to win us over again, have they?
That Amazon is the one I always keep meaning to watch.
Yeah. Mozart in the Jungle, hello. Yeah,
well, I started it and stopped. I started it and stopped. But like, I've never watched Rob Delaney's show, which I hear is funny. I've never watched.
That's on Netflix.
No, it's on Amazon.
Oh, it is?
I thought it was Amazon.
It's on Amazon.
Oh, okay.
I've never seen Sneaky Pete. I've never seen, you know, Man in the High Castle. Like, all these, I keep hearing about
Fleabag.
These. Fleabag.
Am I supposed to be watching Fleabag?
Fleabag was delightful, and I watched half of it. Like, are streaming platforms having all of this money? Well, Netflix more than anybody else, having all of this money, are they too much slamming it down on old people who aren't working hard anymore, your Woody Allens, or are they taking too many risks on people who haven't figured out what they're doing, say, Leslie Arfin's Love?
I have to say, my favorite Netflix stuff, because I was just thinking when you were asking Karen that question about, like, what are your big takeaways, what are the things you like the most? Most of the things I like on that that service are retooled IPs. So I like, with the exception of Iron Fist, which was a shit show, I like all of those, their Marvel shows. I like Daredevil, Jessica Jones. I'm excited about Defenders. I like the Gilmore Girls reboot. I like the Mystery Science Theater reboot. And I like the series version of Dear White People.
Uh-huh.
So these are all things that existed before that they have just found a new way to kind of put a new spin on, and I'm liking that stuff. But those all came to mind before I would think of something like Love
or Master of None,
or Master of None, or House of Cards, or whatever. Like those are the ones. Those are the ones that I think I hold closest.
But, also, House of Cards is a repurposed IP.
Yeah, that's true. I forgot.
And isn't
yes.
The Crown? Well, isn't The Crown basically like a co-production with another major company? It's not really an exclusive
like
Netflix.
BBC or
it's
something.
It's not an exclusive Netflix property.
Oh, thing. That's interesting.
Yeah. So that's the thing. It's like it's crown jewel. The Crown is not its own.
It is interesting how much they're getting into interesting businesses like that. Like there are some sitcoms that are going to be coming out in the fall in America, but then Netflix will own them for the rest of the world. Mm-hmm. So
Riverdale, I think they have everywhere but here.
Oh, that's very interesting.
Yeah.
They have their hands in everything, which is neat, but you have to wonder when the bust is going to come.
This just takes me back to things like I remember the indie film studio boom of the 1980s, where you had all these small companies like Vestron and Film Dallas, and you know, the whole business practice was like, okay, we can pre-sell the video rights to this movie, and all the video stores will buy this cassette, and then we'll take that money and we'll make the movie, and so then anything we actually earn will be gravy. But then you make so many of these sort of mid-budget, not big star movies, video stores stop carrying them because nobody wants them, and the whole bottom falls out of the market.
Alonzo, I'm dumb. I never realized that that's why the indie boom of the 90s happened, was because of video stores in the 80s. That's fascinating. But one of the things that was really lovely about The Incredible Jessica James is that it did have a New York rom-com, not fully baked, but full of interesting characters kind of feel that reminded me so much of your great Parker Posey vehicles.
Sure.
Your party
like
girl.
Kissing Jessica Stein.
Your day trippers. Yes.
And they're still making, and Netflix is making that kind of movie. Like, if you look at something like Deirdre and Lainey Rob a Train, which is the second feature from Sydney Freeland, who is a trans Native American filmmaker who started out with a movie called Drunktown's Finest. This is like, it's a fun movie about teenage sisters sort of like pulling a job, you know.
But is the answer they should start giving people 2 hours instead of 10 hours to prove themselves?
And I the movies seem to be going away from Netflix, but the, you know, the film critic in me wishes that they would keep that.
Yeah,
and you can still get it. I mean, you can still see Jacques Rivette's 13-hour Out One on Netflix.
And Young Frankenstein.
You've got a whole day to spend on that. You know, and odd, you know, art house titles will pop up on Netflix for who knows what reason, but and it won't be on Filmstruck or anywhere else. And so I'm still grateful for that. I miss the movies. You know, I have a DVD that I never sent back to them after we cut that.
Well, I do think people are finding smaller. People are finding smaller movies on Netflix because there's a movie that I loved from last year that got a scant release called Take Me to the River.
Yeah.
And I get a little email every day from The Wrap where I review movies that sort of tell me what my top 10 things that were clicked on. And for a long stretch of last year, Take Me to the River was one of my top 10 most read reviews every day. And the only place people were finding that movie was on Netflix.
That is that way that it is similar to the 80s when people started finding things and having a like reaction to them and then wanting to be like, wait, who? Because you weren't watching it at a theater. You were like, who else saw this? Like, what, you know, what is this? And there is something charming about that, about having discovery and then having to go search through and find reviews and figure out if anybody paid attention.
And
to
with a
thing.
Film like Take Me to the River, I guarantee you, I've seen it, so has Alonzo. Word of mouth on that movie is probably strong enough that one by one people are getting to it because it's a very tense sort of like what's going to happen next, you don't know, it's freaking you out kind of family drama.
With a dollop of queerness.
And I can imagine that A Christmas Story, how that happened in the 80s where one by one people said to each other, have you seen A Christmas Story? And you're like, no, what's that? And then they handed it to you or they made you come over. That's probably what's happening with Take Me to the River.
The streaming platforms should be well built for like subcultural movies, for movies that speak to sort of like communities within the larger community of America. I am always surprised at what shitty gay selections Netflix has.
Wait, let's not forget though that Netflix gave us the Babadook as a gay
that is
LGBT
wonderful.
Icon, right? So that is one of its greatest impacts on culture in recent decades.
It is a manifestation from the fact that they just didn't have that much
really
stuff there.
Shitty gay
so
movies.
That anyone who clicked through the gay movies was immediately like the Babadook. But very funny comedian Joel Kim Booster like went through and watched all of the gay movies on Netflix
last
year.
Jesus.
And I was like, hey, so did they have Jeffrey? Did they have, and you know, the lovely things that we got in the late 90s when they thought they could make gay movies and they were wrong. and they had none of those. They were all weird, like shitty things, but not even like the eating out movies. And it's interesting that you also don't seem to have great selections of other sort of like communities who have sort of smaller budget film cultures.
Well, and I think one of the things that I miss about, remember this, the Netflix used to have a thing where you could see your friends' queues.
Yeah.
And you knew
like Spotify where you can kind of see.
Yeah, so you knew what they had lined up and you could read their reviews. They got rid of all the reviews. Now all you can do is thumb up and thumb down things. You can't even give them stars anymore. But it used to be that people would actually be able to go on the Netflix site and write things up. And so you could find out, well, your friend who you know has similar taste of you, oh, he liked this and thought it was interesting. Well, I should check that one out. That's all gone. And I think that really would help people in finding these sort of odd little corners. I hope I've sent you all to the slow TV corner, but you know, and I'm sure people listening to this episode are like frantically writing stuff down, but that's, there should be, it should be within Netflix that people are having these conversations and making these recommendations or warnings.
But I feel like some of the problem is that everyone wants to be a content producer. Like being a content producer is fun. And they've stopped approaching it like a tech company that brings you movies and have started approaching it as a film studio that has, or a television studio, actually, that has just a different distribution system.
So it's basically like when you go to Disneyland, you know, they're only going to promote Disney product at you to look at. And so, yeah, I think they're pushing their own stuff to the top of the pile, certainly. and I'm sure maybe, you know, the things that they spent more on and they need to get, you know, they have to make it work for them.
Yes, but it's also almost like Disney started out as a mouse delivery service and then turned into this.
But I'm really curious to hear what you have to say, Guy, about the various Netflix comedy specials that have been produced and released and, you know, like what, you know, how they're doing on that front, like selecting the people to make these things.
Well, I mean,
aside from the fact they haven't given you one red yet, which, you know,
bastards.
We all know that they should.
Well, Ms. Mindy Kaling did recently tweet, "Why haven't they?"
Exactly.
Which was most appreciated. What's very interesting is there sure are a lot of them, and the quality varies because of that. The quality varies greatly. I mean, but the cool thing is a lot of people are getting an opportunity to find their audience. And, like, after Cristela's series, Cristela ended, there were so many people who were like, we want Cristela content, and then she produced this great special, and it worked great. Ali Wong came out with her special, and they promoted it very heavily, and they, like, let everyone who should know about Ali Wong know about Ali Wong. There's a lot of stuff that's just gone under the radar, and sometimes that was because it wasn't that great, and sometimes it was because that just wasn't the thing. You know, when they're producing one a week, right, it's hard for people to know what they're supposed to pay attention to, and a lot of comedians are worried about our comedy boom hitting that point where it goes bust again because people just have so much of this stuff. Luckily, everyone who did a CISO special just is fucked now.
It's just subprime mortgage crisis.
Right.
The subprime comedy crisis.
Among comedians, is it a different cachet to say, I got a Netflix special? Does that not sound as cool as I got an HBO special, or is it the same thing?
It doesn't sound as cool as an HBO special, but it sounds very cool. It's better than an hour on Comedy Central, I would say.
Really?
Okay. Yes. And the thing is though there are always those people where you'll talk to them and be like, yeah, do you ever think about maybe getting a Netflix special? And they're like, yeah, I have one. And it's rough. And also people have been doing, you know, with comedy specials, there's always the trouble of like, are you doing something stylistically interesting? And Netflix has given us the opportunity to see some that are terrible. There was one, a comedian I love and respect so much, but it was done all in one shot, and every review was about how it made people seasick. Like, it was just a stand-up special that made people seasick, and what a terrible situation to be in. But they made a really smart move this year. The glory and drawback of Netflix is that they do not have the same army of executives nitpicking everything, and they're also making everything. So they can make infinite volumes of stuff. They can make things be as long as they want. But this year, they made 6 half-hour specials, which was a really great and sophisticated choice. And some of them, like Fortune Feimster is a comedian who I would love to see an hour from and who had already done a half hour on Comedy Central. So that was a little bit like, it's Fortune, why don't you give her more than that? But like, they got some really, really great comics and gave them a shorter format so that people could get to know them and maybe realizing that like, you do more to stoke stand-up by doing something like creating a showcase show instead of giving every motherfucker an hour and 15 minutes. Mm-hmm. You're listening to Pop Rocket. We'll be right back after this. Guys, think about the last time you went into the pool or the beach. Chances are you needed a swimwear update. Join the swim trunk revolution today with a fresh pair of Chubbies. I just got a pair. They are delightful, a great fit for even a man of my carriage. Karen, what do you look for in swimwear?
Well, I look for something that actually exposes my great legs.
Uh-huh.
So I feel like, you know, a lot of these trunks are a little bit too long. And from what I know of Chubbies, they have like they have them at the perfect length.
Get with the times, people. Chubby swim trunks are made with just the right amount of stretch to give them a great range of motion. The fabric is so soft and comfortable. And let me tell you about their designs. They're really cute. I got one that was called the Odysseys, and it was like fun and maritimey. They're cheeky and adorable without being too much. It's swimwear. Its job is to be in the background and be supporting you. So go to chubbies.com/rocket now to get free 2-day shipping on your order. That's Chubbies, chubbies.com/rocket to get your Chubbies in just 2 business days.
Hey, Max Fun fans. It's me, Jesse, the owner of Maximum Fun. I've got a question for you. Will you help us make our shows better? We wanted to find a way to find out what the Max Fun community thinks about our shows. So we started something called the Max Fun Listener Panel. Basically, you subscribe to a podcast feed, and twice a month or so, roughly speaking, we'll send you an episode of a show and instructions on how to fill out a quick survey about what you think about that show. 10 questions, nothing too crazy. You'll be hearing existing shows that we're thinking about making changes to, secret pilots of shows that we're developing that you'll only hear this way, shows we're considering adding to the network, and what you think about them really matters to us. So to join the panel, it's easy. Just go to MaximumFun.org/listener panel. That's MaximumFun.org/listener panel. Thanks for helping make Max Fun better.
Welcome back to Pop Rocket. I'm your host, Guy Branum. With me in the studio are
Alonzo Duraldi,
Dave White,
and Karen Thompson.
And every week on the show, we ask the question, what's your current jam? Alonzo, what's your current jam?
Well, you know, as I said last week, all of my jams are going to be from the Pleistocene. I was thinking more about the whole summer jam, summer song notion.
Thank God.
And this is a song that is about summer, and it fits into a groove that I really like, which is that sort of like 60s minor key overblown movie love theme. This is actually from the early 70s, but it's a Michel Legrand jam from the movie Summer of 42. And it was the kind of movie that everybody is song. Sorry, the kind of song that everybody covered. You know, there's a Sinatra, there's a Barbra Streisand, there's a very purple Sarah Vaughan version floating around. I happen to be a fan of the one by Laura Fiji, who is this Dutch cabaret singer about whom I know very little, but she put out an entire album of Michel Legrand songs and a Christmas record, so I'm in for that. And so this is her crack at The Summer Knows.
'60s, man.
It's definitely very slinky in that Michel Legrand way.
Oh yeah, no, and believe me, if I played you the instrumental break in the middle, that string section should have filed for overtime because they were giving it hard.
I also really enjoy that you apologize for not knowing enough about a Dutch cabaret artist. Dave, you got a jam?
Well, you know, I did. It was SZA's Drew Barrymore, but then nuclear war became a threat.
Yeah.
And that turned our home into a week-long, let's just be comfortable and soft and quiet, the summer knows. And I started listening exclusively from Wednesday until today to an 80s record that I got back in 1987 called Le Mystère des Voix Bulgares. You may not know it. You may know it.
Oh, I went to their concert when I was in
college.
Me
too. Yeah, me too. 4AD put it out in the 80s. It was, if you were dressed in black and listening to Dead Can Dance, you got the Le Mystère des Voix Bulgares album as well. And they were brilliant to name it that because the group itself is the Bulgarian State Radio and Television Female Vocal Choir. They sing arrangements of Bulgarian folk songs. And they harmonize in a way that is so gorgeous and so life-affirming, and yet occasionally so strangely dissonant that it sets you on edge for a second, and then they pull you back into their bosomy embrace. If Wilson Phillips had ever learned how to put that little bit of grit in their harmonies, they'd still be rolling today. And the Bulgarian State Radio and Television Female Vocal Choir is, they're at Royce Hall probably right now.
That's where I saw them.
Yeah. And
they haven't left.
The not jam is called Polignala e Todora, English translation, love song.
It's lovely. It sounds a little bit like the aspects of Christmas I don't enjoy.
Well, it's announced from The Sound of Music. I actually, you know, there was a band up in the Bay Area that was kind of like a lady anarchist, queer, bisexual version of the Bulgarian, La Mystère de Voix Bulgare, and I would go see their shows, and they were definitely inspired by their kind of crazy dissonant harmony.
Right.
So it brings me, throws me back that harmonic music.
You got a jam to throw at us?
I do, and it's also a not jam, but it is an earworm that worked its way into my head after the events in Charlottesville this past weekend, and I'm just going to go ahead and play it, and I'll talk a little bit about what it is.
You've got to be taught to be afraid of people whose eyes are oddly made and people whose skin is a different shade. You've got to be carefully taught.
So, for everyone who's not in this room, I'll explain what that is. That is carefully taught from the Rodgers and Hammerstein musical South Pacific. Lieutenant Cable sings the song after encountering a kind of revelation, spoiler alert, of mixed-race children of one of the main characters, Emile Debeck, and also kind of experiencing an interracial love story himself. You know, the theme is very much on the nose. Rodgers and Hammerstein wrote this, or the show came out in 1949, and it seems particularly relevant to bring it back and to kind of hear as a reminder the extent to which, you know, our backgrounds, our environments, and the extent to which hate itself is really kind of fostered by the people who reared us and raised us. And anyway, it was in my mind this weekend. I could have chosen the Mandy Patinkin version from the orchestral recording with Kiri Takanawa and Jose Carreras, but I figured Mandy's in a little bit of trouble on Broadway, so I'd choose something more innocuous, and that would be Matt Morrison from Glee singing this in the revival show in 2008.
What are your thoughts on production and consumption of these sort of like mid-century musicals, particularly with hokey, white-centric, nice messages about diversity? Flower Drum Song is a little bit different because it is that magical first musical we got about Asian Americans, but it's also Rodgers and Hammerstein giving us their version of Chinese American San Francisco. But you do have a lot of these things that are like giving you a vaguely nicely post-World War II message about diversity.
Are we putting West Side Story in this category?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, West Side Story. Yeah, I mean, so many of the shows of that mid-century period were really kind of trying to grapple right away with some of these issues. I actually, you know, my feeling about them is that they were doing the kind of cultural work of their time. They're of a historical moment where people were kind of trying to work through these issues. And so sometimes you can, I believe it was, you know, Rita Moreno who was talking about like, or maybe, I can't remember if it was Rita or Chita who was talking about like, you know, feeling really weird about singing the Puerto Rico, you ugly island line.
Yeah.
In West Side Story. And
I think Cheetah, because I think they take, I don't think it's in the movie.
It's
version.
Not in the movie. It's true. They took that out. And Rita Moreno was relieved. It was Rita who was talking about how she was worried about singing that line and that she was relieved that they changed the lyric because she didn't want to have to sing that.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I don't know. I think that they're important historical cultural documents about, you know, people trying to feel their way, of well-intentioned, you know, cosmopolitan New York liberals trying to feel their way through the difficult issues of their time.
Yeah.
And I think that the more these shows are revisited and adapted, and people like David Henry Hwang revisiting Flower Drum Song, the better it is for, you know, understanding where our ideas about race came from.
I don't have a jam because I was irresponsible this week. All right.
But we have to give them, we have to do the, we have to wrap up the summer jam season though, right?
Oh,
soon?
Or yeah, very soon. I mean, we're in August. So you guys, it's down to the wire now. Throw down with anything you've got. We've had a lot of really late contenders. Your Kesha coming out of nowhere. We'll be assembling them and we'll be talking about them in the next couple of weeks. Labor Day is a-coming. You've been listening to Pop Rocket, hosted by me, Guy Branum, with Dave White. Dave, thank you for joining us. Where can people learn more about your work?
Linoleum Knife. That is the podcast that I co-host with this person right here named Alonzo Duralde.
And Alonzo, thank you so much for your continued replacement of Margaret. I'm sure if the two of you decide to have a child, Margaret would be more than willing to do the same on Linoleum Night.
I'm the Charo that didn't marry Xavier Cugat.
And Karen Toxin. Our theme music is Party Booby Trap by Ozzy Muzo. Thanks to him for letting us use it. Thanks to Haunted Reality and Lynne AMC for the 5-star reviews on Apple Podcasts. If you haven't already, please review us. Lynne AMC was excited that I played a nurse on the Mindy Project, if I would like to mention that, and I would.
Nice.
People need to remember that I also have SAG insurance. get in touch with us on Twitter. We're at Pop Rocket, or join our Facebook group and join in the discussion. We are a production of MaximumFun.org, and our producers are Christian Duane Yass, and the brand new producer, Casey O'Brien.
The baby face Casey!
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.